Good afternoon and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers, and we are here every Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It is such a pleasure to be here in this program. We've got a very, very exciting program tonight. For our normal listening audience, you know, usually we come on with our song of introduction as well as our poetry, but tonight we're going to kind of forego that. So we want to get right into this dialogue because it's just so critical. And we have three dynamic specialists who are working in this area that we want to talk about. So we want to give them the full realm of time to do that. I see that our young man has just come online that does our ancestral profile. So we're going to be getting to him in just a minute. But as you know, we are here, as I said, we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10. We are also on Saturdays on the Blog Talk Radio platform. We are there from 4 to 6 p.m. With the Black Reality Think Tank as well. Our program tonight is a part of the TimeForAnAwakening.com radio system, which is a part of the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. And Black Reality Think Tank is developed by the Sankofa Historical Society. And we have two programs that we design. We have this Black Reality Think Tank, and we have another program that airs on Sunday evening from 11 p.m. to 12 midnight on the Blog Talk Network called Gospel Gold. It is a program that highlights the history and development of gospel music in the Black community. A very dynamic show hosted by Reverend Michael Rogers, who is the pastor of Holly Springs Baptist Church out of Holly Springs, North Carolina. And this show is very dynamic. It's picking up a lot of steam. You get a chance to learn and hear about the history and how that music has impacted Black life. So it's a wonderful program to listen to. So go to that on Sunday evenings from 11 to 12. You can go to their website, which is Gospel Gold on Facebook. They have a Facebook website called Gospel Gold. And that way you can hear and find out how to link on to that program on each Sunday evening. And as I've said earlier, the Black Reality Think Tank is on these two formats, which is the TimeForAwakening.com as well as Blog Talk. We also have a website on the Facebook called the Black Reality Think Tank. And each week we do list where the program will be located and the link for you to be able to do it and get on. So with having said that, we're going to get right into this dialogue. But first, we have to honor the ancestors. It is a part of our regular tradition here on the Black Reality Think Tank. As I've indicated to you many, many times, when we honor our ancestors, our soul breathes. When we honor our ancestors, our soul breathes. So we must do that. And we have Mr. James Scott, who is from Peoria, Arizona. He is now on the line with us, and he is going to give us our ancestral profile today. Good afternoon, Mr. Scott. How are you this afternoon?
Hello, Dr. Rogers. I'm with you.
Okay.
And thank you.
Yes, sir.
Today, I will be presenting an ancestral profile on Mildred Fay Jefferson. Mildred Fay Jefferson was born on April 4th, 1926, in Texas, where racism was normal to see. She was the only child of Mildred Jefferson and Guthrie Roberts. Jefferson finished her early education by the age of 15, being a highly intelligent child. She graduated summa cum laude from Texas College in Tyler, Texas, with a bachelor's degree in medicine at the age of only 18, and later graduated from Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, with a master's degree in biology in 1947. Jefferson received a PhD from Harvard Medical School in 1951, becoming the first African-American woman to graduate with a degree from a medical school. Mildred Jefferson was one of the top women to serve on the staff at a hospital, period. After graduating, Jefferson became the first female surgeon general at Boston University Medical Center, while also being the assistant clinic professor of surgery. In 1961, she married Shane Cunningham, but were later divorced in 1978. Jefferson got her start in activism by helping to establish the Massachusetts Citizens for Life Council. In 1970, decisions by the American Medical Association to allow members, physicians to perform abortions ethically in states where procedures were allowed. She saw this decision as an abandonment to a hypocrite oath, which demanded a doctor to do no harm. She began to speak out against the procedure nationwide, which made an impact amongst all. In 1970, Jefferson was asked by a colleague to sign a petition started by physicians who objected to American Medical Association decisions to defer to state law regarding abortions. When their efforts failed, she and her colleagues formed the Value of Life Committee, one of the organizations that initiated the National Rights to Life movement. She served on the organization's first board of governors, and she also became a pro-life spokesperson, mostly in 1973. Dr. Jefferson co-founded the National Rights to Life Committee and served as vice chairman of the board in 1973, chairman of the board and president in 1975. She claimed responsibility for bringing future President Ronald Reagan into the pro-life movement after hearing one of her lectures. Jefferson took her anti-abortion campaign into politics, running unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate from Massachusetts four different times in 1982, 1990, and 1994. Mildred Jefferson was awarded 28 honorary degrees from multiple universities and colleges. She then was even president of the Value of Life Committee of Massachusetts while being a member of the Black Americans for Life Committee. She founded the Culture of Life Studies program, which she promoted in public schools across the nation, but later passed away in her home. She did so much for the African American community, and I thank her for that. I would like to conclude with a quote from Dr. Charles Drew. Excellence of performance will transcend artificial barriers created by man. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Scott. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I know yesterday I was looking at the news, and I noticed that it was 117 degrees in Arizona. Is it still hot like that today?
Yes, it's very hot, Dr. Rogers.
Okay, you said that with some enthusiasm. So, well, stay cool, Mr. Scott, and I will talk to you on Saturday for our Saturday program. Take care. Thank you.
Sir.
Okay.
You too.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are ready to begin. As I said, my name is William Rogers. I am the host. We have a wonderful group of individuals that are going to talk with you. The topic of our discussion today is real men don't beat their women. Real men don't beat their women. Healing domestic violence in the African-American community. And we have assembled a wonderful staff of individuals, experts in the field, people who are working daily on this circumstances, and they are here to talk a little bit about cause, effect, solutions. That's what we are looking at. Now, just for the sake of the beginning, I wanted to just kind of share with you why I thought this topic was necessary for us to do here on the Black Reality Think Tank. And as I indicated in all of our promotions, I indicated that we have to address this issue now. We have to do it now. We can't wait till later or wait till you get some money or grant. You got to do this now. We have to address this. I think that all of us African Americans have somewhere along the way touched in a situation of domestic violence, whether it was a direct way or in an indirect way. But we all have done that. And it's always puzzling for me to try to understand that from both ways. I was confused about why would a woman stay in a situation like that, you know, where sometimes she's being abused and she continues to live in that household. Why? You know, why would you do that? Why would you stay there? Why would you expose yourself and your kids? So I don't know. I'm just an outsider looking in. And so that's why sometimes the experts have to explain. And then the other part is, why do men do that? I mean, this is somebody you say you love, somebody you want to be with, somebody you care about, somebody that cares about you, and then you beat her? Yeah, I don't understand that. You know, I'm confused. And so obviously, again, being on the outside, I don't know, and I need to. We need to have a better understanding of that. One of the things that I wanted to do in preparation for this program was to do just a little bit of a historical background research on this whole activity and just to kind of see where it starts from and where it's rooted. And I wasn't able to get a lot of detail So I looked at Africa first and looked at how the African system understood it. And actually, in most of the African cultures that I looked up, in the modern times and even pre-colonial, because obviously one of the things you have to look at in terms of African behavior and social activity is you have to look pre-colonial, because when the colonial period is operating, you know, that's a whole nother environmental change. But in pre-colonial Africa, that wasn't an accepted form of behavior. That was not tolerated. In one culture I looked at, they even would warrant death if a man did that. So that's not something that's indigenous to the African culture. So then obviously, where does it come from? Well, obviously, it's clear that the African experience in America obviously begins out of the system of captivity. And in the system of captivity, it appears obviously that this is where we will begin to encounter that, because there is where you begin to get the division of family and children and such this horrendous history that we all know about. So, but anyway, I wanted to take a look at that today and have this group tell us what they see on a day-to-day basis as they encounter both victim and victimizer. What is that they say? How do you bring that together? And so we have assembled three wonderful individuals, three friends who I have known for many years. I have watched their work. One of the members of the panel was a former student at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, so I know what he's got going for him. He's real strong, he's very knowledgeable, so I'm glad of that. And then one of our guests has been a guest before here on the Black Reality Think Tank, talking about this very subject and talking about her work, as well as talking about her book that she has recently published, you know, on this this whole discourse. So I want her to talk about it. She'll talk about that too. So what I'm going to do, first of all, is I'm going to just introduce them by name, and then I will have them just briefly tell you a little bit about who they are and what they do. And then we'll get into the discussion. I have a lead-off question that I want to begin with, and we'll go from there. So first, I'd like to introduce to our listening audience Dr. Alice Belcher of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Good afternoon, Dr. Belcher.
Good afternoon, Baba. How are you?
I am wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Honored to be a part of this discussion with these dynamic other men on the program this evening. I wanted to just say, too, Baba, that I was also one of your students at the University
of Wisconsin. That's right. That's true. I'm sorry. I forgot that. That's right.
And since that time, I want to remind you, since that time, I've been...
time flies, man. I tell you, right?
I've been working in the genre of family violence from the prevention perspective, has been primarily my focus. And as you mentioned, I have most recently released one of four books in a library series of books. I've written a library series, the Alice Belcher Family Violence Library, and it speaks to family violence prevention. The one that was released that you referenced was Prevention in the African American Communities. The other one is on healing people broken by violence. The third book is Systemic Abuse, Revictimization, and Unintended Consequences. And the fourth book in the library series is The Church and Its Role and Responsibility.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to your input on this discussion and you bringing that expertise, to our conversation. Okay. Our next guest panelist is Mr. James Mosley. I've known Mr. Mosley a long time in Milwaukee in all kind of formats and programs. He's been a very active community activist, very powerful brother. I love him dearly. He very cares for his people. And so we're really happy to have him on this evening as well. So with that, I introduce to our listening audience, Mr. James Mosley. Good afternoon.
Good evening, everyone.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming to.
Good. I'm glad to be here. My name is James Mosley, and I'd like to start out with honoring my family and He's been in Milwaukee about 100 years.
Right.
That's rare, very rare. And so I give honor to my ancestors and family who made sure that I have been given a good and steady moral constitution to be of service.
Yes.
More than anything else. So I've been doing work and community work since 1968. So this year I'm celebrating 50 years in human services and community service, both church work and community organizing and all kinds of other things involving the Milwaukee community. So I've been working in Milwaukee, Chicago, and Detroit.
Great.
Background is in a graduate university of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Also, I spent 6 years on the faculty of the Institute of Cultural Affairs in Chicago, a research and training organization. And currently, I'm working at the Alma Center. I've been there 10 years. And I teach restorative fatherhood, men ending violence, curriculum and courses for the Alma Center. And I've probably taught about, conservatively, about 3,000 classes over the years, conservatively, with men. So I've had an opportunity to work with men for quite a long time, and they've heard all kinds of stories in both of transformation and struggle, and et cetera. So I want to bring that piece to the table, the internal journey of what happens to a man when he makes the change to not to be violent.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to your input as well. Thank you. This next, our next guest, I am so very proud of. I had an opportunity to watch him maturate from a young man in Milwaukee, working with his father, who was very active in the African Senate School Movement. He was a part of his dad starting several choice schools in Milwaukee, as well as participating in one of the best choice schools there was almost in the country, Harambee Community School, and also watching him develop his own school. And this young man was right there by his dad. His dad is now transitioned to the ancestral world, and he is now taking the helm, and he's doing a powerful job, and I'm just watching him grow as a beautiful, wonderful, active young wife who also is right by his side in everything he does. He also was a student of mine at the University of Wisconsin, and I didn't have to stay at him a lot. He was always natural. He came to the table natural learning, and I'm sure he remembers the good old critical thinking days, and so he can remember my fussing about being a critical thinker. But anyway, I'm happy to introduce to our listening audience Mr. Katanga Alexander. Good afternoon, my brother. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm doing well. And yes, indeed, I do remember that critical thinking and those critical thinking lessons.
Yes, right.
In fact, I still utilize a lot of it today.
Yep, that's good. That's great.
That's a little bit about my background. I am the coordinator of the Welcome Home Project right now, which is a program designed to give an authentic welcome to members returning to the community from incarceration. I'm a former men-ending violence instructor with the Alma Center. I have a background, obviously, a bachelor's degree in anthropology from UWM, a master's degree in business management, and currently working on my PhD in anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Beautiful.
I also have a background in education, K-12.
Beautiful. I didn't know that. I didn't know you went back for your PhD in anthropology. That's great.
Yeah, I snuck that one in on you.
Yeah, you did. You sure did. I might have to fuss at you about that for not telling me. But that was good. I'm glad. I'm very happy. Thank you so much.
Appreciate
well, again, I thank all three of you for this and for your participation today. And hopefully our audience can be empowered by our discussion. And we can have somehow or the other make some changes, even if it's just in the case of those in our community who are doing this kind of work. You can add some additional things to that. Okay, here's the lead question, getting right into it. As is you remember our former alderman who was also a radio personality at WNOV for a while, Alderman McGee, Michael McGee. He always used to talk about, let's get to the butt-naked truth. And so that's what we're going to do right now, go to the butt-naked truth.
All right.
During my years,
yeah.
Right, I was, prior to being in academia, actually I was a police officer. And I was a police officer in New York City, in Brooklyn, at the 84th Precinct, which is downtown Brooklyn, 84th Precinct, right up under the Brooklyn Bridge. And I remember most of the calls that we would get on an evening would be domestic violence calls. And if I had to sit down and tabulate what they were, most of them were domestic violence. And I recall we had a procedure. My partner and I would go to the scene, and our first thing was one of us would take the man, pull him away, take the woman, pull her away, and separate the two of them. And in the cases where I always pulled a man apart, he always would say to me, out of stress, he said, I love that woman. I love that woman, but she talked too damn much, you know, and things like that. But I can't stand that, you know, this and this and this and that. So let me ask the three of you. If a man loves a woman and this is his soulmate, why in the hell does he beat her? Please tell me that. I'm going to go right to the naked truth, and you got to straighten me out. Maybe I didn't even paraphrase that right, but that's the way I see it. I'm talking about from what I see. So let's start with you, Ms. Belcher, then go to Mr. Mosley, and then Mr. Alexander.
Well, domestic violence and why men beat women is multifaceted. At the core of all of it, bottom line, is power and control. They don't do it to gain power and control. They do it because they're entitled to feel that they have that power and control over women or in general, that they're entitled. It's like it's an entitlement. So some would say, and some of the research bears out, that it's so multifaceted. For some, it's a matter of economics. Let me explain by that. The access to employment and economic self-sufficiency is very important. And so when you throw in racism and that disparate impact on Black people, specifically Black men, who for decades have been unemployed at a rate double that of white men, it speaks for some men measures of their manhood. Primarily their ability to provide may not always be there, so being denied that access to means to provide can cause some men to seek power through dominating women. And that's just, you know, one or two, you know, facets of it. It could be other issues as well that can include, you know, the mental health of men who I'm specifically talking about Black men, our community, we're talking our community, who do this as well. And again, some of those mental health issues could be related to stressors of living within a racist environment and community. But then there's, I mean, you know, but there are like 1.3 million American women, period, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, who are experiencing domestic violence or intimate partner violence every year. And women are making up 85% of those victims. And of those victims, Black women, who we only make up 8% of the population here, we're still making up 22% of the homicides that are resulting from domestic violence on Black women. Okay? Mm-hmm. So these are real serious, serious issues, and I've only given a couple of causations that the research shows for some of the reason, and I'll let the other panelists certainly add to that.
Okay. All right. Mr. Mosley?
I want to take a piece out of the group I worked with before in the past is Call the Man. And one of the reasons for men accepting and buying into the culture of violence is because of some distorted views that are internal in male culture. and in male culture, there's some subtleties and even direct practices and beliefs. And there are three that are promoted by the call of men. One is that inside male culture, there's this understanding that women are less than. And so you have the, you know, pay and all kinds of things that come from that. Women are paid less, et cetera. You know, you got all of that. But that's in culture, and it affects economics, it affects personal relationships. You find it in institutions, et cetera. So there's those beliefs that are part of, that are inside of male culture. Another one is that women are property. Now, she belongs to me. That's the piece that Dr. Belcher was talking about, power and control. Mm-hmm. That's the idea of women are property. And in the culture, that women, quote, belong to men. And so some of these are old values, but they're weaved into many of our own institutions and systems that we are engaged in. And then the other thing is that women are objects, and principally objects, which then primarily sexual objects. So women are used to sell things, they're used to promote things, et cetera, around things that are that satisfy men's desires. So inside male culture, you have those kind of distorted values that a lot of men and boys are exposed to early on. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Just for the sake of our listening audience, you are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We are talking today about the issue of domestic violence in the black community. Why do men beat their women? And we have three dynamic panelists who are giving us their perspective, who work in the field every day, who encounter both victim and victimizer. And so we want to encourage you, if you would like to call in, if you have questions or you want to make a statement. Our call-in number is area code 215-490-9832. Repeat. Area code 215-490-9832. And we welcome your call, your comment, and we would give us a chance to share that with our panel and let them respond to what you might have to say. Okay, Mr. Alexander, same question.
Okay, to answer that question, I want to start with the idea or the notion that hurt people.
Okay.
And when we couple that with idea of the socialization of boys to men, we start training our boys almost as soon as they could walk, talk, that they have a limited range of emotional training. You know, when we put our boys into categories of not being able to express certain emotions and being able to express certain emotions, what we are usually able to express is anger, which turns into violence. Mm-hmm. Most people say that's the limited range of emotions. I add one other emotion to that that training. It's the emotion of laughter. We're able to laugh at things and we're able to be violent about things. That's why we make the best comedians, and that's why we are always, we committed 86% of all violent crimes. That socialization doesn't change in relationships. It becomes a detriment to relationships because we have people who are grown. Academically, they're intelligent, but emotionally, they're very young because we stopped training our boys at maybe the age of 2 or 3 to cope with emotions. So when they were in relationships and things or certain emotions come up like sadness, well, if we don't know how to operate sadness, we don't know how to relay sadness, we transform that into violence, and that leads to domestic violence.
Right. Okay. So let me make sure that for our listening audience, as I surmise what the three of you have said, is that a lot of this is internalized oppression by the victimizer. These are situations and circumstances that they have encountered in their developmental life and coming up, and these are things that weren't healed or taken care of in a way that needs to be done, and as a result, then they play out onto other people, in particular their women, the people that you love. I remember there was a song years ago says you always won't hurt the one you love, the one you shouldn't hurt at all. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like that. Am I correct in making that summary?
Yeah. I think so, Dr. Rogers. I would just add, when my brother talked about the socialization piece, that we understand how far back that began. And you talked earlier about the antebellum period, the slave period, that was learned behavior. And you saw how women were treated, primarily, the juxtaposition between how Black women were treated during that era and moving forward, and how white women were treated. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that has a bearing on us. That has impacted the social psychosis of Black people. And it's kind of a carrier through today as far as Black women. Our value, as Black women, our value to this moment isn't always perceived or projected as valuable as other women who don't look like us.
Okay.
So there's a perception that, we are somehow either are invisible or are worthless or valueless, or this is okay to do to us because it has been done to us for about 330 years of slavery, approximately.
And that's that concept, like say, in that we've learned in culture, from boys all the way through, of women being less than.
Correct.
Okay.
See. And so when that's learned, then it has its effect all the way down the line. As an example, when a young boy, as Katunga was mentioned, when you get involved, if you start getting involved in sports or anything like that, the whole notion is that you make sure that you don't play like a girl, say. See, that's less than.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, so we've got these terminologies that are placing women in these degraded positions in mind and in belief, and operating out of these things unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it even happens in the sports area. I was explaining.
Mm-hmm.
So. And this has all been a part of what is happening because of our oppression and not seeing, a sufficient number of role models and how we are to treat women with honor and respect.
Okay.
But again, learned behavior is, when you look at family after family, generation after generation, the repetition of certain habits, certain beliefs, certain ways that we operate with each other within family itself, and then when you're outside in community or you're outside in society,
right.
Sometimes you have to hold on to those distorted values in order to survive.
Okay. And I understand very clearly what the both of you have said in relationship to that. There is one element that I do want to ask that we haven't touched on quite as of yet, is it's popular culture. The attitude in the popular culture of American life is that women have a subservient role. Very clearly that they have a subservient role, that they have that they need to keep their mouth shut and stay in the kitchen, stay pregnant, those kinds of ideologies. We see it in motion pictures, we see it in songs. I recall several blues songs that always place women in a very negative light, even to the point of saying that woman sure talk too much, she got a big mouth. You always ask me for money, give me my wig, I bought you back, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and that's grained into the culture of life, and then even to the point where back in the 30s and the 20s, it was okay to beat a woman if you, as long as you beat her with something not as big as your thumb, which is where they say the rule of thumb came from. And so it was okay to beat her, you know, if she was acting up. You came home, didn't cook your dinner, you get a stick and you beat her, you know. What about that? Where does that come in? How could a law like that get passed in a country like this, you know? And I mean, I know that there are other countries that have these strict rules. You watch the Saudi Arabia, you watch the Islamic world, some of the Islamic world stuff. So can you respond to that for me? How does that get ingrained into all of this? And what impact does that have? Because that hadn't gone anywhere. That's still around.
True. Well, if I may
speak,
many states right here in our United States had chattel laws on the book. Like, women and children were considered chattel, like property of the husband. So you do what you want with your property. You know, and even though, and there may be some states, I don't have to look and check on Wisconsin to see, to just double check, that may have had those laws. They're not exactly written off the books. They're just not enforced. You know, that women and children work are considered, you know, property of that person. So when you have a legal systems, justice systems approving that as such, then you're going to have that kind of behavior acted out upon them. And women will suffer disproportionately, and particularly for women of color who look like me, there is that strong sense of cultural affinity and loyalty to our community and to our race that does sometimes, most times, renders us silent. So we don't talk about what we're going through. I mean, we have the most untold stories in the world of what we've gone through because of our affinity for culture and our loyalty to our community. There's that hesitation that's an impediment to us in trusting police or any justice system. My God, I mean, we just don't as a whole, because as Black people, you know, we don't feel comfortable surrendering our own, you know, our men to those racial, to what we often find racially biased police states and situation. And as women, we don't feel safe calling the police, who may in turn harm us or, you know, kill the person or someone that's, you know, in our home, or take our children away, which is happening a lot. So when we speak out or seek help, so there's a lot of different backlashes from members of our community that happens to us and or our children when we begin to talk about it. They consider it, the people still consider it, oh, you're airing your dirty laundry, you know, and you're making us look bad in front of, you know, people or white people or people don't look like us. So there's a lot of reasons why those things are continually happening to women who look like me.
Okay.
I think you find it also in our religious institutions.
Oh,
yes.
Interesting.
Unfortunately,
interesting.
You know, what was so interesting, I grew up Catholic. The men as priests, and the women's were the nuns, okay, in the religious community. But they were, had more subservient kind of roles and weren't involved in the liturgy or any of that. Now, I said that same theme runs through our religious institutions today.
Okay.
When you look at some of the major faiths do not allow women to have a role, even in the liturgy. So what is that saying?
Mm-hmm. You're less than.
Is there saying there's some divine division,
right,
in creation,
yeah,
where there's some unequalness in creation?
Right.
So when it comes, when we look, right, at the moral foundation that we're building things from, and from that, society is supposed to branch out from those. Well, if that's what we're teaching, that's what we can expect in society.
That's an excellent
in communities
point.
And in families.
Excellent point. Yeah, because, you know, even that, right down to whether or not women can preach in the pulpit. You know, Dr. Belcher is minister, Dr.
I'm an ordained.
You know
minister,
the
yes.
You know the challenges that you have about being in a pulpit.
To this moment, there's some places I go into right now. I don't get set in the pulpit. I don't get recognized as that.
Right, exactly.
Like, oh no, not church.
Right. So I think that's
some of that is not related to race. It is a ingrained gender belief system that, in my mind, is just inappropriate for how we were created.
Okay, right. And even what supposedly
so that is a human being's interpretation.
Right. Exactly.
And it has stemmed. See, the justification of a level of inadequacy, a less than, someone's not appropriate for, etc., right within the moral fabric of our society, communities, and family.
Right.
So from that standpoint, see, there needs to be some questioning about that.
Okay.
Because that is, again, it's a root. It's a root belief. That they have grown the wrong way. Why are we feeding that?
Sexism is definitely a part of the reason why we're seeing it. It is why women are suffering is disproportionately like this black women, but why women are suffering this kind of abuse, it is complex. And for us, it is grounded in sexism, as Mr. Mosey has said, and it is grounded in racism.
Right.
And these are huge obstacles that we face.
Exactly. So is that what has to be worked on as well? As you were, I know you've got to deal with the direct, immediate situation, but is there a way that agencies such as the ones that you all are part of, is that something that you need to do? Is the black church, for instance, preaching against domestic violence? You know, like, you know, you talk about AIDS, you know, AIDS and the whole situation of AIDS. Obviously, you got to deal with the direct issue, individuals who have contracted the disease. But then you have to also deal with the culture that opens it up for the possibility of AIDS to take on place. So do you do the same thing in domestic violence?
Oh, yes. One of the four books that I mentioned I wrote, the fourth one is The Church, Its Role and Responsibility for Family Violence. And not only is the role and responsibility in terms of if you're the blame, but it's role and responsibility in terms of preventing it and turning the ship around. And we do have to own our piece of it in terms of how we have interpreted scripture. And this is not just the Christian church. I mean, as Mr. Mosey said, you'll find this stuff in Catholic church. You'll find it in the mosque. You'll find it in the black church. You'll find it everywhere. So we do have some role and responsibility as to how women are then as to the lens by which women are being viewed, which is enabling them to be harmed, and how we're going to fix that, and how they can fix it, because the churches, the synagogues, the mosques, all of these places have the largest ability to access an audience, the largest amount of audiences on a weekly basis, for sure.
Okay.
You know, I remember, you know, when they signed the Civil Rights Bill,
right,
back in the 60s, and there was all black men that were there, and the core of the people who had done the majority of the work and the organizing were women.
True.
And that's what made the civil rights movement. It wasn't just the preachers. It was the sisters that was going out and doing the work and doing the door-to-door stuff and making sure people were cared for when they came to church and were having different events and things like that. Now, that the movement would not have grown if it had not been for women.
Okay.
And we know that.
That's
but
true.
At the same
That's right.
time, you have this ceremony, you know, then there's no women there.
That's right.
So I'm just saying there's things that we've got to look at in our own history where we haven't included the sacredness of women in the movement.
Amen.
And all the way through. And that's what I'm saying, these fundamental beliefs that are distorted have come from these institutions that are not understanding the quality of creation.
Right, right. Good point. Excellent point.
I would add in on the, because you mentioned music and entertainment
right.
in general has historically been a male-dominated field. You can have the women as entertainers, but as far as the production, as far as people with the money to pay for it, it's been male-dominated, and for the most part still is, even though it may be, it could be argued that it's somewhat better now, it's still heavily male-dominated. And so when we see images of or hear music that speaks to that, or see images on TV that speaks to that, and now probably even more than hearing music on the radio or seeing movies on TV, is being able to access all of that over the internet through a computer or a simple smartphone, we're able to still see how sexism and racism is played out, almost fantasized or fetishized with these images from this male-dominated system.
Mm-hmm.
Addressing that, of course, takes a lot of work, but yet still in 2018, it's still very severe, if not just as severe as it was maybe 60 or 70 years ago, because of how much access people are able to get to it now with smartphones and whatnot. I mean, you can essentially get to anything.
Right, right. And you're right. That is, I'm still to this day appalled at the level of the music that's being pumped into our young people's minds. You know, these kids are obviously, they're walking around with their iPhones and their smartphones, and they've got these things plugged into their ears, their earbuds, and the stuff that's coming out of those instruments going into their brain is just frightening when I listen to some of those songs. And a lot of times I'll ask young people, when I say young, I'm talking 8-9-year-olds, I ask them, who do they like in terms of rap music? And a lot of the women tell me, I like Cardi B. And I said, okay. I said, does your mother know you listen to Cardi B? I don't know, you know. Or either they'll say, I like Rihanna, you know. And it's just, like I said, it's just very weird. When you listen to their repertoire of music, you hear something. Let me ask a question. I want to kind of maybe just have one of you answer this, and because you are specialists and professionals in this whole domestic violence situation in our community, can you frame for me a statement that would say why domestic violence is disruptive for our community? Now, I know there is an obvious answer to that, but I want to just articulate a statement that says, you know, why this will destroy our community if we don't do something. So either one of the three of you can take a stab at that. If you've already got something that you're working with that you can use, that's fine. But I want something for our audience to walk away with that indicates, you know, why they got to take advantage of this and take advantage of it now, even if they are not a victim. It has to be addressed. Why does this situation of domestic violence destroy the black community? So either one of you can take that.
Well, what I see is that it's, and I see it in the men that I work with, okay? I'm going to have to go back into the family.
Mm-hmm.
I also do prison work too as well. I go to Racine Corrections in Oshkosh, and I go there on weekends and visit the men there as well. But when I hear men's story, and this isn't, I'm not trying to get into judgment or blaming or any of that, but this is just information that was, you know, passed on to me, is that sometimes there are things that happen in a man's young boy's life that has serious consequences. And so the very fact that sometimes when we can do things as parents and not know the damage that it has. I had one guy who tried to see his father, and his father – would never see him. And so I kept on, I said, well, what was so bad about that? He said, he would see me out the window, but he wouldn't pay no attention to me. Mm-hmm. He knew I was his son. He lived in a different house. I'd always go by and see. He wouldn't recognize me. So that inability to be recognized, and he said it just that sat in him, and it just made him angry. Mm-hmm. And so his father didn't want to recognize him. Mm-hmm. He said that later on, when he got involved in the streets, and he became the guy who pistol whipped people, okay? And so he said every time he pistol whipped somebody and beat up somebody, it was all because he was angry at his father. Mm-hmm. Now, we can say he wasn't supposed to do that, and that wasn't nice to whatever. Yeah, we can say that, but when this energy of anger is there, it just like engulfed him. And so he finally got to the point where he recognized how hurtful that was. And he finally said it, that really hurt. And sometimes we hold these secret feelings, and men do that. We have these secret feelings that we won't want to say nothing to nobody. Mm-hmm. And we know this is hurting us or whatever it may be. We won't say anything, but then we'll take it out. Because it's in us, okay? We got to take it out on somebody. And so that's what we end up doing. So we end up violating somebody with violence.
Okay.
And so this guy would pistol whip people. And so he maintained this understanding that this was the start of my anger.
Okay.
And it happened in my own family. So that's not the one thing, but there are a lot of things like that over right. time, things that happen inside families that need to be corrected and can be the cause of some type of horrendous effect down the road.
Right.
I totally agree. Mr. Mosby, the one thing I would add to that question about how domestic violence impact the family, what had happened, how it can destroy, I think is what Baba said. When you think about, because my studies are concentrated in how all of these things impact the Black family and Black women, their children, Black husbands and wives. So when I hear that question, Baba, I'm thinking about Black women and how we have been ignored. And I'm just going to tell the truth. We say, the buck naked truth, okay? So for the experience of Black women have been ignored, particularly when it comes to our overall well-being and health and things of that nature. So for centuries, our bodies and our labor and all of those things in our bodies have been exploited to serve the needs of everybody else but ourselves. Slavery to the day. Right. You know, right. Somebody mentioned earlier about the music, to sell your music, to, you know, sell whatever, you know, video vixens and you know, breeding plantations from slavery to this day. Women's bodies are being used and trafficked. And so the physical and the psychological toll, people, can no longer be swept under the rug for how it's impacting us and our families. Black women matter, okay? And the longer we remain invisible and the longer we continue to have our dignity and our humanity stripped and disregarded from us by the violence perpetrated on us by our own Black men.
Right.
The closer we are getting to the destruction, the final destruction of our families, which means our communities go the same way.
Right.
Now, that's just the bottom line. At some point, I know women, you know, women, we do our thing over here as it comes to DV and we meet and greet and we work with each other. And men, they meet and greet over here and they work with each other. And we do need that. But at some point, we need to come together after we worked apart. We're forgetting the third piece, bringing it all back in, okay, and figure out how we can walk back this physical and psychological abuse of us as Black women, which is stripping our families, which has stripped us of our dignity and humanity as women, and it has destroyed our families and communities.
I do agree, 100%. And that's one of the things that we've tried to do here at the Black Reality Think Tank, is to focus on that discussion. We have a young woman, she is a part of that post-millennial generation. She is hosting one of our Black Reality Think Tank programs, and she's coming on, and she talks about the relationships and how relationships are catastrophic, even for her age group, which is in that 30s, that early 30s, late 20s. And she comes on. Her name is Shani B. She'll be on this Saturday talking about relationships. And you're right. That has to be addressed. That has to be addressed. I had one question that I do wanted to ask real quickly, because we're moving to the top of the hour, and I want to go to our listening audience. We have several callers online, and we'd like to get to them with their questions. But before we do, I've got two things I want to talk about before we get to that part. I had mentioned it, but I didn't get an answer. Is the Black Church addressing domestic violence? Are they doing special programs or pastors using the pulpit to talk about this?
I don't think it's happening as much as it could happen. I've had small successes. I don't think it's being used as much as it could be used. I've had more success with being able to train non-Black church members and clergy to do the work, and then they're actually speaking to it, than I've had in our Black community in Milwaukee. Now, maybe Mr. Mosley and some others have had better success rates than I, but I haven't.
Okay. Does the Alma Center work with any churches and pastors in terms of doing this work? Brother Mosley?
No, we don't. We're pretty much limited to the educational program because of the shortage of staff, and you know, we're not able to do outreach because the extensive amount of time it takes, you know, just to do the number of classes with the 100 and something men that we have, you know, Monday through Fridays.
Let me just be clear that Impact Coalition for Families, which is my nonprofit outreach program, does community education surrounding this genre. As a matter of fact, we're doing a training this Saturday at the Brown Deer Library. We do them all the time. We reach out to churches all the time to come in and train. We've worked with the organization Pastors United here in Milwaukee historically to train clergy. But when it comes to the one-on-one, you know, reaching to the pastor, maybe we've trained some people from their congregations or saying, you know, can we help you utilize the social workers and everybody else that's already sitting in your church, you know, to empower them to do it. We don't get no amen right there. So it's not that we're not doing it. That's primarily all the Impact Coalition for Families does in that community outreach education piece.
Right.
Which is facilitated by me, but the reach back is what I'm saying. as forthcoming in the Black church as we get it in the non-Black churches in the greater Milwaukee and surrounding area communities.
Okay. And the reason
I just want to say a quick little thing and kind of center in on a piece of the conversation that we always have seen is very, very critical. And it's really about the issue of trauma that has really destabilized, and from a man's standpoint, in terms of how we work with men, is that the experience of trauma has been really critical in working with our men. And once we discover what some of the core trauma is in a man through our conversations on one-on-one and classwork and everything, because we work with them 6 months now. And so once they're able to work through that, you begin to see a shift.
Okay.
You know, and we call it the healing. It starts to take place. They really begin to open up. And so we're able to kind of tap into that truth and most emotional intelligence. That doesn't happen to everybody. But when you start seeing that shift take place, and the guy that had been violent before, in his relationships, in his family, with his children, everything, and that shifts, that's a remarkable thing. And he begins to realize what was the core of his violence. It was in that trauma that he said nothing to nobody about. That was his secret little place that he held all that anger and hatred for a lot of different things.
Right.
And that's to me, I feel that's one of the core pieces, as we can work with men to help them work through and help them heal the trauma that they've gone through. And there's a lot of trauma that happens when guys go to jail, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they're re-traumatized over and over again. And then when you get out here in the community, and, you know, you look at all of the things that keep reinforcing the trauma that's out here.
Okay.
And so this is the work we've got to be able to do, help a man really understand how to face those difficult feelings inside and be able to be honest with himself, to understand that he is vulnerable and that he's not a Superman or anything like that, but that he's a human being, he has feelings, and learns how to understand and work with his feelings. And the misunderstanding is that we've been taught as men that we associate feelings with the feminine. And that's a lie.
Correct. See?
Emotional intelligence, that's what it is. That's what feelings are.
Mm-hmm.
It's our radar. It's our sensory sense. It's just all of that. It's an intelligence. It is not the touchy-feely stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when you understand
interesting.
How you can convey that, you know, with an understanding that, yeah, I really love you, you can say that and not be embarrassed, I'm being touchy. No, I mean that, see?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when we can do that, to understand that I'm showing you some respect, some intelligence about who you are and how I believe you are.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can have men do that and not be embarrassed by it,
mm-hmm.
You got something. That's the beginning. Men beginning to understand how to tap into their emotional intelligence, because they've been using it all along, but didn't know what it was, because it was given a distorted understanding. It was distorted.
Powerful. You know, and thoughts like that, Brother Mosley, leads to so many questions that obviously we just don't have enough time on a two-hour program to do. This is a part two kind of discussion, which we definitely will do.
Yeah.
But I agree. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of it from that perspective. But that definitely is a very powerful concept.
Well,
you're right.
We talk with men enough to know that when we get down to that core stuff, that's at the core.
Right, exactly.
That's at the core. That's the secret stuff they're not going to tell you about.
Right. Okay.
I certainly agree that we need to advocate for more treatment options for abusers or batterers and victims who seek help. And we do need to fund advocacy programs and supportive services for victims and batterers, and to work on reducing the stigma mm-hmm. attached to seeking help,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're in trouble. I agree with that totally, Mr. Mosley.
Okay. I've got last question.
It's difficult for us. One of the things that makes it difficult for us, because it's the fund services for men.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, people say, well, what? Why can't they handle it? I grow up, man, just figure it out. You know, you're a man and what, you know, there's these issues that people have about funding for men's services. It's like, for what?
Because they're the perpetrators and the ones that need the help.
Yeah. See, so you don't need no help. Lock them up, you know. I'm saying there's this distorted understanding, see, these concepts.
Well, we do need accountability, but we also need treatment.
Right.
We need them both. We need accountability, advocacy, and treatment.
We call it compassionate accountability.
All right.
There you go.
Compassionate accountability. Okay. All right.
Compassionate accountability.
Let me go to this question, because I do want to get to our listening audience. I have several email comments that I've gotten from our audience. I got one that's very interesting, and I would definitely like for him to share that and talk to us about that and ask you about this particular point of view. However, there's one thing I want to ask before we do go to our listening audience and take this one break. As I indicated to you in the beginning of the program, when my years in the New York City Police Department, recalling the majority, as I said, of the calls that we would get on a given evening, most of them were domestic violence situations. One of the things that I also witnessed is when we would get to the scene and you would separate the male from the female, and if the male was a little resistant, sometimes, and you had to give a little bit of strong force. One of the things that I've noticed in several cases is the woman would get hostile toward us and say, don't hurt him. Don't you hurt him? And other comments she would make like that. And then we would even ask her, does she want to go somewhere for the night? Does she have somewhere to go? She said, no, we're going to go in here and work it out. So the question I'm asking, you know, help me and help our audience understand, what is it that keeps the woman still connected to a situation like that? What makes her still stay with that man? In some cases, now I grant all of them, I'm sure all of the cases are not like that, but many of them I know, the people that I knew in my personal life that were involved in domestic violence situations refused to leave the man. Could you please tell me why?
Well, it's multifaceted. Let's start with one.
I agree.
One, she loves them, okay? Two, it could be, as I said earlier in the top of the conversation, it's this whole thing where Black women tend to, particularly, and women in general in some cases, but particularly us, we put racism before that other piece. You know, so there's this distrust of those systems. There's this distrust of police. We don't want to call. We don't want you to hurt them. We don't want you to shoot them. We don't want that. We just want, like, behavior to stop. So, and then there's a piece of financial. Maybe he's the breadwinner. Maybe if he goes, who's going to pay the mortgage? Who's going to pay the rent? Who's going to do whatever? Then there's the whole cultural piece.
Oh, see.
You know.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's multifaceted. We could talk about that's a whole show, Bob.
Exactly.
Okay, that's interesting. And I'd like to talk about that because I just haven't understood that. But it makes sense on what you're saying because then that puts her in a position of having to be independent now in a way she may not have been prepared to do that right away because usually there are children involved in a situation like that. Yeah, so, okay. All right. I like that. Mr. Alexander, any thoughts you had on that?
Well, I think that she hit it on the head about it being multifaceted because all those factors come into play. And even the first one she said, which was love, like that doesn't necessarily erase when domestic violence happens. So you have the situation where you have now law enforcement who many individuals in the Black community automatically have a natural fear for, and they're in the environment now. So just like she said, now you have to pick and choose between racism or sexism. And for Black women, they usually are expected to and have been putting the needs of others above themselves. So that's where that comes into play.
Okay. All right. Okay. We're going to go to our audience and ask that, see if they have questions. This is the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. And we are also on Blog Talk Radio on Saturdays from 4 to 6. The Black Reality Think Tank is a development of the Sankofa Historical Society. Our point and position is to understand history so that we can kind of be able to dissect the present and offer some type of valid response to future building and development for our community. So that's our work here. That's why we're here every week. We are an African-centered perspective. We believe and love and focus on our community. And so we have an opportunity. This program is tonight. Is on the timeforanawakening.com platform as well as the blacktalkradionetwork.com. The Black Reality Think Tank on this platform is sponsored by Motherland Media Network, which is a development of Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, who is a former Milwaukeeite as well. He lives now here in Atlanta. He has a program also that airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday called African Perspectives. And that program comes on from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, here on the timeforanawakening.com. Very dynamic program, African-centered, looking at the whole idea of liberation for our people. Also, there is a program that airs out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, called Time for an Awakening. And that program is hosted by Brother Elliot. who is basically the lead reason that we are on this network now. And Brother Elliot airs on Friday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time here on timeforanawakening.com. And this is actually his network. And Brother Elliot does the same thing. He has a wonderful collection of guests that he does look at. And he is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network, which is another whole dynamic system coming out of, I think it's, they stream out of Texas, as well as, I believe, Chicago, I think is a part of that. But anyway, it's timeforanawakening.com. You can go to their website and look at the very large array of other black radio talk programs that air as well. And so those two formats are also a part of this system. So we are happy to be here. We are happy to be on this network. And our discussion today is real men don't beat their women. And we need to address this as it relates to the black community. Also, I want to remind you not to forget the other Black Reality Think Tank program that airs on Sunday evening from 11 to 12 noon called Gospel Gold. It's a program that talks about the history of gospel music and the impact that it has made historically on the black community. A lot of the Underground Railroad happened because of black music tradition. And this particular program talks about some of that as well as some of the other things. The motivation behind a lot of the civil rights movement had a lot to do with the music. And so that is hosted by Reverend Michael Rogers, who is the pastor of the Holly Spring Baptist Church in Holly Spring, North Carolina. And he hosts that program every Sunday evening from 11 p.m. To 12 midnight. And we really appreciate him for doing that. So we are going to go to our audience now. We want to see what they think. If you have a question or a statement, you can call us here at area code 215-490-9832. And when our audience completes their questions and their comments, Brother Alexander, I'm going to go to you, and I want you to start giving us some kind of understanding of how all of this impacts what Michelle Wallace calls the new Jim Crow, or basically the new slavery, which is obviously the system of incarceration, which is, I know, the specific thing that you do in your program. You work with those men coming out of prison. And I want to know how does that impact that. Her name is Michelle Alexander. Thank you, Brother Griffin. She definitely has talked about that new Jim Crow and the new slavery. And I think we all agree that the prison industrial complex is a part of the new slavery system. So I want you to talk about that for us when we finish with our questions and remarks from our audience. So let me go to Brother Griffin, Otis Griffin. You have a comment that you put on the board just now, and I want you to, if you don't mind, ask our question to that audience. And I think that they are open and enough to receive that. So would you go with that? How are you doing? First of all, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing fine, sir. I hope you can hear me. Did you unmute me?
Oh, I hear you very well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to eat up a lot of time because I'm interested in this response. I'm going to lay down the predicate real quick and get this from the experts. 1970s, I worked at a Big Brothers program.
Okay.
I also know that since 1964, the primary breadwinner in black households has been single mothers. So I want to ask you people, who has taught these young men that might makes right? And I'm going to say this. The biggest problem I had working in Big Brothers is when I got the kids alone and I started talking to them, they were getting beat with belts, switches, and anything else that the parent, the custodial parent, had in their hands. And I already made it plain to you, most of them were single mothers. So I want to know why we're not addressing who is teaching these young men that might makes right. And I know for myself, I didn't become a father until I was 40. And one of the biggest problems I had with having three sisters and a mother is you need to whip his so-and-so. You need to be I'm telling you that if we're going to make a change, we need to know the history. But we need to also work with who is teaching these young men at such an early age that might makes right.
That's a great question. Great question. I can't wait to hear this answer.
Well, according to the Bunsen-Brenner theory and ACES studies, those influences come from everywhere. Yes, some come from their home, some come from their communities, some come from their schools, some come from their churches, some come from friends, some come from family,
right.
Some come from what they see on TV. So I'm not going to say, oh, it's a single mother that's teaching might makes right. I mean, children are influenced, are pressed upon their development from the womb to the tomb. It's constantly under the Bunsen-Brenner theory, pressed upon by their environment. Totality, no one singular piece of environment. That's why you could have a family that has two, three more kids, and they all grow up and they raise in the same household, but these kids come out differently. You know, some may be scholars and go on to PhDs. Some may spend more time and they're just different, coming out the same household.
Okay.
Because they're pressed on by an entire environment.
You're kind of breaking up real bad. Is your phone away from you?
I'm sorry.
You were breaking up.
What I was saying, and let me repeat it really quickly. The Bunsen-Brenner theory speaks to how children are influenced from the womb to the tomb by their environment. So to say there's just this one thing that influenced them to take on this behavior or that behavior would not be correct.
Okay. Okay, your phone's still drifting, but okay, I think we got the gist of your answer.
Dr. Rogers.
Yeah.
One thing, I didn't accuse anybody of anything. I asked who is teaching them this violence. And I know from experience that a primary and one of the most integral parts of it is what's going on behind those closed doors where they're supposed to be safe. Now, I'm not going to argue with you over the theory that you said because I've researched that too, and I agree. And I'm saying to you, I know that's what's happening in that home has a lot to do with whether or not they'll accept what they find when they get outside that door.
Well, now you're saying something a little different. And yes, I do agree that the home is a major influence on child rearing, but you prefaced your statement in question by singling out single mothers. That's why I addressed it from that lens. But now what you're saying is slightly different. Of course, the household is a primary influence on how children are reared and developed and what they will and will not accept from the other pressures of society and environment.
How is what I'm saying any different? I say that for black and white households.
We didn't talk race. You prefaced your question with talking about single mothers and since 1964, and then you state your statement and ask your question. So I, through my listening lens, I interpreted that to mean that you were referencing single parent households.
Okay,
by women.
Let me go over to Mr. Mosley. Mr. Mosley, what are your comments to the gentleman's question?
I think because the caller, I can hear his television, why we're breaking up, Dr. Rogers.
Okay, you said you have...
Well, violence is learned. Violence is learned.
Okay.
And it can be learned in any kind of environment.
Yes.
And there are kind of... I like to use... What kind of happens when a person's kind of sense of self is violated? That's really the seed for violence. So if you have your dignity and your self-worth, your self-identity assaulted or questioned or not appreciated, you feel hurt. You feel violated, okay?
Okay.
If you have your freedom taken away from you, you have no sense of order around you. Everything is chaotic. you have no control or taught self-control, and you wonder why that's going on. You can get angry about that, okay? And what I'm getting to is simply that there's some basic kind of things that where people feel violated. If you don't feel connected, you don't feel loved, if you don't feel important, and a sense of importance about you, you're significant, you're valued, that can hurt people.
Okay.
So these little things happening when a person is young can then grow into bigger things as they get older.
Okay, let me ask this, and I think this is where I'm
blaming. If you're not in a safe environment, all these things are part of the things that can create, even in the adult, okay, a need to sometimes be frustrated and being stressed, and sometimes that gets taken out on the children. That okay. can happen.
I think though that
so now
Dr.
We're actually then projecting our feelings onto the children, and then that's learned behavior.
Right.
Okay. And then the next generation, they do the same thing.
But Mr. Mosley, Mr. Mosley, from a historical standpoint, and I think one of the things that Mr. Griffin is asking, and I think my concern is that as well, is a specific point. I think I understand what you're saying in general, in a general way, but specifically. Where children are in a home, and it doesn't necessarily say, it doesn't have to be single mother, it could be mother, father, could be grandmother, aunt, where discipline is patterned or positioned out based on a belt or a switch or some other thing that we know we all have encountered. What I think that we are asking, what is the impact of that? Is there some statistics, is there some studies that show that is catastrophic?
That's punishment.
Okay, so is that catastrophic? Does that lead to some of the things that we are seeing in domestic violence?
Well, you should be able to discipline your child without, let's not confuse discipline with abuse, okay? Now, right. you cannot abuse
a thin line.
There are laws against that. And you should not abuse your child, because if you abuse a child, they're going to grow up. They're going to start cutting up pretty early. And, you're going to be wondering why we see a lot of stuff that we see out here in the streets like these kids, because that stuff, you're abused in the home. But a parent can discipline their child, but you cannot abuse your child. And I know in the state of Wisconsin, corporal punishment is not illegal for a parent in the state of Wisconsin.
But isn't that a thin line? That's a thin line. That's a very thin line, isn't it?
Excuse me?
It's a very thin line.
I said, but you cannot abuse your child and leave marks on your child. That's abuse.
Right.
Now, for me as a parent, I don't hit my kids. I've had dogs. My dogs learn to obey me by my voice. So okay. If I can train a dog to obey me by my voice, why can't I speak to a human being, my children, and raise them and say, do this and don't do that and sit and come or whatever?
But again, the question is there a study, or is there something that has been done that indicate?
Well, there are studies, Dr. Rogers, Bible, that indicate child abuse has a negative impact on
children. Not just child abuse.
That's the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences.
Yes.
So what I'm saying,
what constitutes child abuse? Well, if your child felt, if you're harming your child, if you're physically harming your child, if you take an extension cord, snatch it out the wall, and you're beating this child, and you're leaving welts, and you beat like he's a slave tied up to a post, I don't necessarily know if that's considered just discipline. I think that might, I think that's a little bit of abuse, and that's going to be negatively impacting on his mind. So what I'm saying is, I think we have to unlearn some things. I think we have to unlearn what we may have passed out through the generation. When did we start learning about whipping our kids? Well, a whip dates back to what? Slavery, tying up slaves with a whip and whipping them.
So is that the best method
to do today? Maybe not.
It comes back to the whole issue of parenting and the proper form of parenting. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm trying to say.
That's true.
Right. Exactly. Okay. All right.
One of the things I teach when I teach my fatherhood course, I make a clear distinction when I'm talking to the fathers. I said, let me tell you something, okay? I said, punishment, it comes from the word punitive, which means to hurt.
Yes.
That's what punishment is. It means to find a way to hurt. Punitive, punishment, same thing, hurt.
Okay.
Discipline simply has to do with that's a lesson. You're going to learn something from it. You're going to talk to the child. You may have to give them something to struggle with or whatever it may be. I don't know. Take something away. The child has to be creative and figuring out. The parent has to be creative in what they do.
Okay.
But when abuse comes into factor, that's punishment. That's abuse.
That's
where violence starts. Violence is learned.
Okay. Okay. Let me go. We've got a lot of folk on the switchboard here that may possibly want to add to that. Let's go to this caller, area code 267-333. This is a brother from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, member of the Nation of Islam. How does the Nation of Islam see this whole domestic violence situation in terms of the teaching, first of all, of Elijah Muhammad and then Minister Farrakhan? How does that work in the Nation of Islam system?
Well, Dr. Rogers, first I want to thank you to say that I'm also in your classroom. And I refer to you as a master teacher. So you still need
you.
So I want you to know that we're all learning from Dr. Rogers. You might not be on the call all the time. The callers that he has that come on and the people that he invites, we are happy to be here.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to say, sir, that in the Nation of Islam, we have an FOI class, which is the training for the men. We have an NDG class, which is the training for the women. But I want to say this about when it comes to music, that Percy Sutton said when a man loves a woman, he can't keep his mind on nothing else. And I myself, man, I have to realize that you love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. But love is slippery when it's wet. I have slipped off my square at times. I'm also going to say that Aretha Franklin sang a song called Respect. Otis Redding from Stack Records from Memphis wrote it. If you listen to it, it's from a man to a woman. Exactly. And she sang it, and you listen, she said, he said, all I ask is a little respect when you get home, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say this, sir, that a book that I read, I put on one of my high shelves in my house, and a lot of people wanted to ban the book, but the woman wrote an interesting book because she let out an interesting thing on, she's talking about a specific woman. She's not totally talking about the whole women as far as the black race is concerned. That's a Shahrazad Ali.
Oh, okay.
And she talks about interesting book. And in the nation, we're talking the man is the administrator, he's the director, he's the protector, he's the guy, and the woman is to help me. Now, of course, the man has to be on point, meaning has an economic background, he's somehow gainfully employed for the household to be running right. But she brings about an interesting thing in her book. She does an interesting study, and she says that the way that the woman is raised, that she is raised to take the man down. Now, she does an interesting study because she says that that as a result of the man being stripped of his government and we being raised, the male and female, he's like a foster father to us, that she sees us through his eyes. In other words, she doesn't look at us as a full man. You see, and she's saying that I don't think she meant harm, that her mouth can be a weapon, okay? That she's in it for the money. And this is a particular woman. She's not talking about a total black woman. And she says that at times when there's problems domestically, the man may result in hitting the woman. She didn't say that you should hit the woman. And when she was all around the nation promoting this book, they would bring up that part. But she brought up some interesting things. She said he's been stripped of his government, that oftentimes he's not gainfully employed. And the way she is raised, she sees through the eyes of the white man. But we're raised in this society, in this system. We've taken on his culture. We've been stripped of our own. And I think that offensively, a lot of black women say, well, we're stuck with the man through slavery. We're sticking to the man right now. Well, we're not, and that's true. But see, everybody has talked about the man. He's not in the household. Okay. She brings a point out on the woman. And I want to ask you your opinions of it. Now, I'm not trying to beat the black woman down because, listen, my mother's a black woman. My great-grandmother's a black woman. And I got a woman, and she's black. I want another woman. I just want a black woman. And I ain't going away without my black woman. But I want to know your position on what she said about that book.
Okay. All right. Anybody want to speak on the Sharazan Ali book? Okay.
I have not read it.
No, I haven't read it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll come back. Yeah, let's go over. I realize that maybe everybody that's on the switchboard may not want to say something. So I'm gonna, if I call your number and you don't have a desire to say anything, then you can just keep quiet. If you do, then by all means, you have the platform. So let's go to area code 919-450. That's Durham, North Carolina. 919. 450.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Oh, Brother White, and, how you doing? I thought you had abandoned me.
Hotep to your panel.
I said, I thought you had abandoned me, but...
No, I just got distracted a little bit.
Yeah, Brother Bridges told me that I'm glad to be
listening to the show again.
Okay, great.
I wanted to comment on what you said to start the show.
Okay.
When you dealt with pre-colonial Africa.
Okay.
So the question becomes, how did we get from there to here?
Okay.
So we have 300 or 400 years of all types of abuse that we had no recourse in. And so what did it leave behind? And domestic violence is only one of the negative aspects of our captivity. Mm-hmm. And when you look at domestic violence, the abuser finds people he can abuse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If a man was married to Mike Tyson's sister and Mike was sitting on the couch, he wouldn't hit her no matter what she did.
Mm-hmm. You're right about that.
And I know personally, I grew up in Brooklyn, I know personally some women that I know that if you hit them today, Tuesday, they'd be burying you on Friday. Mm-hmm. Those women didn't get abused. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The abuser found someone that was going to accept what he did.
Okay.
So his behavior was modified by how much he could get away with and who he could get away with it. But it wasn't something that was uncontrollable.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
He sought his victims out. The woman who, for whatever reason, would stay with him, like you said, it could be financial, it could be, you know, she loved him and everything. Like I said, but I know some women that you can't put your hands on.
No, you can't.
Mm-mm. Under no circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and won't let you. You're right.
And the other topic that y'all spoke on about abuse and children and punishment and everything, I got spanked as a child. Mm-hmm. But there was never a moment in my life that I thought that my mother didn't love me. I knew it all the time. I got spanked. I knew why I got spanked. I had been warned several times about behavior that was unacceptable.
Right.
And I continued to do things that I knew I shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. And the things that my mother chose to deal with me on was things that would have impacted my life negatively in the future in a much worse way.
That's right.
So when you talk about the whippings as a slave, the slave master didn't love you.
Mm-mm.
I know that my mother loved me, and in her love, she said there's certain aspects of this child that I have to control.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so on certain occasions, I got what I needed. And to this day, I sit down and laugh. Me and my brother, we sit down and laugh about things that we got and what we got it for.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, that's a good point, Brother White, because I, you know, we both you and I came from Durham, North Carolina, and those folks there, those elders there, they did not really, there was an old saying, you spare the rod, you spoil the child. And they did it, but they loved us when they did it. And I know my mother took care of me real good. But I loved her.
I didn't beat my wife. My mother just slapped me upside the head or threw something at me or anything. Yeah. All my problems came from my behavior.
My behavior. I did it. I know, and I knew I did something wrong. Yeah, I did.
And I've been warned.
Right.
Not to do this. Why you shouldn't be doing this? Stop doing this.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
It sounds like it wasn't a frustration. She wasn't hitting you that way.
And I'm saying, brother, you just learned something from it, did you not?
I can imagine in my heart that she didn't want to do this.
Right.
These were measures. She didn't enjoy doing that.
Right.
But did you learn something from that?
I know that from all the other things and all the other love that she gave me in every way.
Okay.
And another thing with my mother, if my mother thought that I had a thought of hitting a woman, what would happen to me?
Oh, yeah.
That was made clear.
Very clear.
From early childhood I couldn't be fighting no girl in school.
Mm-hmm.
If a girl hit me in school, I had to go tell the teacher.
Right. So that's
where
she
made that clear.
So I think that's where the argument about popular culture comes in terms of what it did in introducing that idea of using force on women. I think that has a lot to do with the music. Because you know some of those old blues songs, those blues singers, they talked about that all the time, you know, and it was a part of that. And I recall how men... older men back in my age as young people responded to those blues songs. Those were like philosophies. And
rock and roll and doo-wop, everything was about how much you loved your woman.
Right, exactly, exactly, yep.
There were love songs.
Right, that's true. Okay, Brother Griffin, let me go over here. Thank you, Brother White. I appreciate that. I got some more folks on here I need to try to get to. I have a sister here who is... who works in this field as well. She is out of Greensboro, North Carolina. Her exchange 336-621. Good afternoon, sister.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers and panel. How's everyone?
Wonderful.
Good evening.
Well, thank you.
Good, good. Greetings of peace and love. Because it sounds like we need some love up in here. Talking about all this, some beating and whatnot.
Right.
So I want to make a couple of comments. I've been on both sides. You know, I've been in an abusive relationship, and I've also, as a substance abuse counselor, I've worked with people who are men and women who were abused. And so it is absolutely true in my experience that hurt people hurt people, and it's absolutely true in my experience that men are definitely taught to repress their emotions. You're not a man if you express anything other than anger. Mm-hmm. So those are truths. The other thing that I'm agreeing with that I've heard, you know, said on the panel. The other thing, the title of your show, Real Men Don't Hit Women or whatever the title is. I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say that real African men, black men, are leaving this place fast because white terrorism, white pathology, has done a great job at demasculating our men. Mm-hmm. So they're no longer real men.
Right.
And that's a fact. The other fact is that we live in a violent society. America is one of the most violent, if not the most violent countries in this world. So how do we expect for people not to, you know, act out in violence because your society shapes and molds you?
Right.
So how do we even expect that won't be an issue, you know, people acting out violently? And with black men being so severely abused in this country, I'm really understanding through years of working with this stuff that black men are like most other humans. If you can't attack your oppressor back, then you're going to turn around and hit the thing that's closest to you, and that's your woman. You know, I've done it. I had a little dog. I'm going to admit on the phone. I've gotten angry, and I've turned around and just that quick hit my dog. Mm-hmm. You know, because that anger is energy, and it has to go someplace. It can't just sit. Anger has to move. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be healing from those feelings that are buried underneath the anger. I'm in agreement. I heard that talked about. And another thing, I want to make a quick comment. The question was asked why women stay in abusive relationships. So as I said, I've been in one. And dealing with other women that have been in abusive relationships, a lot of women stay out of fear. A lot of men will threaten. I've been threatened, if you leave me, I'm going to kill you.
And they mean it.
Yeah, I've had the windows nailed down and the doors, the locks on the doors changed. You know, you better not leave me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that fear is a real issue that keeps mm-hmm. Locked into those relationships until they find a way to say, you know, I'll be damned, I'm going to die, he's going to die, but I'm getting out of here. And I had to reach that point. And the other thing is low self-worth. You know, if you don't value yourself, you will tolerate abuse.
And you don't value yourself because you've been in abuse.
or if you have years of, you know, if your childhood was jacked up, you know, with so many of us have been abused during childhood. When we get into relationships, we believe that we deserve to be abused. I don't know how many women I've spoken to that said they think they deserve to be beaten and hurt. So, yeah, there's a lot of healing that is required because we're mm-hmm. carrying these belief systems. But, again, the violent society piece, as I listen to the conversation, some of what I hear, and this is not a criticism, but some of what I've heard is what I hear people like, what's that crazy dude that was on Fox News that left finally because he was busted for molesting women?
I can't remember his name.
Bill O'Reilly.
Right.
When you listen to Fox News, you hear them saying a similar conversation that we're having. Well, it's the black family, and they're not raised properly, and they get beaten. You know, it's the same conversation. Okay. For us, my passion is when we talk about these issues, let's look at who we are as African, and I swear I'm going to end with this thing. Before the show, I text my godfather, who is in Nigeria. And I asked my godfather if in Western African culture, is a part of the culture of beating women, giving them black eyes and kicking and stomping and whatnot. He said, no way. That is not a part of who we are.
Right.
So when we came, mm-hmm. when we were taken to America, such a violent, brutal, savage place, unfortunately, we took on those behaviors, and we got to get back to Africa. And that is my solution that I'm going to bring in. We got to get back to being African because that's not a part of our culture.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. As usual, time is creeping. I got a couple of things I definitely want to do. I want to go to, we got three more guests that are here. Brother Marcus is on. Brother Oshie from Africa Perspectives and Mr. Scott, I'm going to come to
Oshie.
You.
Okay.
But let me quickly go to Mr. Alexander and ask him about the work he does in prisons and with brothers coming out real quickly. I do wanted to hear that. Where are you on that, good brother?
Yes, sir. I'm here. The Welcome Home Project is designed to give an authentic welcome to members returning from incarceration. And it actually is in relationship to the topic that we're having of the discussion that we have today. When we're talking about healing, we have a large portion of our men, black men, going in and out of institutions, and the institutions themselves are not necessarily healers to us. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to recreate community, right? Because a lot of the topic, a lot of what we were talking about in discussion today was in relationship to a breakdown of the community. What we're doing is we're trying to recreate community. And I'm noticing something with the individuals that we're dealing with. from the high-risk unit of the Department of Corrections. The majority of these individuals have leadership attributes. And so when we're looking for, like, what's the broken links in our community, well, you know, we've looked in the church, we've looked in the schools, we've looked in the politics, and we're still having issues. So what I'm doing, what we're doing, is we're looking into those prisons. We're looking into the streets, and we're finding people with the attributes, the leadership attributes that can actually enhance our communities. What we're doing is surrounding them with the support to stay on a productive path.
Okay.
The reason it's related to domestic violence is because when we start talking about the reasons for domestic violence, some of the stuff that came up, trauma, pain, historical, and these are the individuals who are dealing with these issues. And domestic violence, as one member of the panel, I'm not even on the panel, somebody called in and said, is one avenue of violence. And I agree with that. So what we're doing is we're taking these individuals and having them become agents for change in our community.
Okay. Okay. Powerful. And I'm sure that there are other things to it, that but obviously time won't let you get into it. So when you come back,
yeah, give me the short version.
When you come back on the next time, and you are hearing what I'm saying, right? When you come back on the next time.
Yes, sir.
Well, when you come back on the next time, we're going to get into a more detailed discussion of that, because this is too critical for us to just be able to do it 1-2 hour. We got to get into more, because we're not even going to probably touch a lot. Excuse me, of the solutions, but I want to get back to it a little later on and do that. Let's go to Brother Marcus out of Arizona. Brother Marcus, how are you doing today? Comments?
Yes, Dr. Rogers. Good evening to you and good evening to your guests. You know, the American society itself is like domestic violence. It's a similar situation that Black people are in. You know, we get abused, and you know we cling to the abuser. So it's a similar thing to the domestic violence in a man, you know, male female relationship. Similar thing to Black people here. They abuse Black people, but yet still we cling to him. You know, don't want to leave him. You know, and also religion plays a lot into it too.
Oh, yeah.
See, because the way it is, religion is orchestrated. God Himself is a male. He, you see, it's a male orientated God. And the way the book of Genesis it says that it is through the woman that sin entered the world, because it was the woman that got beguiled by the devil, the serpent. And ate of the fruit and then gave Adam. So
that's
the way that is written, it put a lot of the blame on the woman. Islam is one of the same thing. Islam, you could beat your wife, you know, if your wife marry out of the religion, that's a reason to kill her, you know. So we have to look into that too, how religion plays into the psychology, you know, of our people. Because again, this is not our religion, this is the religion of the oppressor. This is the religion of, you know, these Europeans, you know, and this is not a normal environment. This is a nut house. So we have to remember that. You know,
right.
I don't think we're going to ever be able to solve our problem in the nut house. And right. I yield my time to other people. Thank you.
That's it. Thank you so much, Brother Marcus. Appreciate it. African Perspectives. Good afternoon, my brother.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. How are you this evening?
Wonderful, my brother. Wonderful.
Good. Once again, yes, it is.
How you doing? It's Brother Moles.
Hey, how are you? It's
good.
Outstanding program, Doc.
Thank you.
One of the things that I want to add is that our understanding of the word discipline.
Yes.
In this society, they use the word discipline when they mean punishment, because there's such a deep negative connotation on punishment, they use the word discipline. What discipline is self-imposed order. That's discipline. When you went to school, Doc, in the study, what do they call the study? They call them what? Discipline.
Right.
Because
I was just agreeing.
Let him complete that, Dr. Belcher, then I can give you a chance to answer that. Go ahead, Brother Osher.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, you have to discipline yourself to go through the rigors of study. You can't be playing bid whist all night, partying all night. You have to be disciplined.
Discipline, right.
See? And so for us, we must discipline our children. not punish them. What we do is punish them, but we're using the word discipline, and it's totally out of context, but that's the society. Okay. I can understand that. And our problem is we don't understand what the society is. The sister before hit the nail on the head. This is a very violent society. Europeans are very violent, the most violent-prone people on this planet.
Right.
You know, one could argue it's their evolutionary development, being in that environment that they grew had to develop in, causing this aggressiveness, sexist, racist, greedy, selfish nature that they have. They have to dominate and control. Here they are, less than 10% of the human population, but yet they control 80 to damn near 90% of the wealth on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever they went, they didn't come to barter. They didn't come to trade. They didn't come to, you know, seek a deal. No, they just came to take. And they use a religion that unfortunately we still gravitate to. We still believe in that they imposed upon us. And somehow we think by believing in that religion that we will have salvation, that we will have peace, because we sure the hell can't in heaven, because we sure the hell can't get it on earth as long as we are dealing with Europeans.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, we have to call it for what it is. This violence, because the brother said, who taught us this? Where did we get this from? We get it from Europeans.
Right.
They have been that way since the inception. I often said, Doc, I said, one thing in understanding this history that Europeans can do is find a better way to kill you.
from Gatling guns to
catapults to atomic weapons. They are the most violent-prone people on this planet.
Yes.
And they're very racist, and they're very sexist. This is who they are as a collective.
Right.
I'm not talking about some individual Caucasians that you may know that are some nice people, you know? And you invite them to dinner, and you might go over their house or whatever. I ain't talking about that.
Right.
I'm talking about the Caucasian collective. I'm talking about the general mindset. That's why you see what's going on today in this country.
Right, exactly.
Collective culture.
Let me let Dr. Belcher, Brother Oshia, answer that. We got about 8 minutes, and I want to kind of go to the last caller. Okay, Dr. Belcher, you want to answer that?
Well, right. No, I was just agreeing with Oshi that it is disciplines, and when we refer to the courses of study across disciplines, and you're learning this and you're learning that, you're learning math, that's a discipline, science is a discipline, you know, so on and so forth. So I was agreeing with that, but I also wanted to speak briefly to the other caller who talked about abuse, the behavioralism of abuse, and he's correct that sometimes I've seen people lately try to frame domestic violence through mental health, and I come against it hard. I'm telling you right now, domestic violence is about power and control. It's not about mental health, because what I often say, one way of even looking at it, is that that person will abuse you, but he won't abuse her, which means he can control it.
Right.
Mental health, you can't control mental health issues. If you're depressed, you depress them no matter who you're around. You understand what I'm saying?
Right,
if
you're
psychotic, you're psychotic no matter who you're around.
Right, exactly.
But whenever you can abuse one person and not abuse another, that means you can control that.
Okay.
So that doesn't make that a mental health issue. Yeah. That's why there's no DSM for it. You understand what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I just wanted to really bring
that's good.
Out.
That's it.
And the other piece I wanted to bring out
we've got one more caller I definitely want to get to. And maybe in your wrap-up, I'm going to come to you for a wrap-up, and then you can give us that. I want to get to this very last caller. Mr. Scott, good afternoon. How are you, sir? Oh, hot Arizona. Hello, Mr. Scott. Oh, okay. I guess he didn't want to say something. He was just all listening. Let me go wondering to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Brother Pugh, you got something very quick you want to say, because we got about 6 minutes.
Yes, Doctor. I didn't think I'd get in, but I'd like to speak to the philosophical question, who is teaching children that might makes right? First of all, when a people are subjugated, that is subject to the arbitrary boundary set by somebody else,
right.
Leading becomes ruling, authority becomes power, and discipline becomes punishment. Oshie is eloquent in his definition of self-imposed order, and also the other gentleman was eloquent in his definition. Martin Haberman wrote a book, an essay in 1995 called Unemployment Training that talked about how parents and teachers were essentially being marginalized, that the system was designed to essentially cause children to have no respect for their parents and their teachers. And by the way, here's a classic example of how this this distinction between arbitrary power versus discipline and authority. Imagine a five-year-old child standing on a bus, standing up in the chair, and the mother is sitting next to him and says, son, sit down. Now, if the son is continuing to stand up, the mother, she says, sit down, and she says it even louder. And then the third time, the mother says, sit down or I will beat your behind. Well, what the child infers from that is not that I should sit down because I'm in a dangerous situation and whatnot. He infers that there's really no reason for me to sit down other than the fact that it's somebody bigger than me, who will impose their authority, their power on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reason I should sit down. And by the way, to make this distinction between authority and power, to make it real simple, the reason that you respect your grandmother is that you understand that even when she tells you things that you don't like, you know that they're ultimately in your interest. On the other hand, the reason that, for example, you will obey an armed robber is because he's got a gun. You already know that what he's asking you to do is not in your interest, but you're going to do it because he has a gun. The final thing, spare the rod, spoil the child. Well, a rod was a unit of measure. So in other words, the notion that, in fact, this would be my final. There was a very prominent fellow in the Milwaukee community who I have a great deal of respect for. I had an extensive debate with him on Facebook because there was a woman who had a child strapped to a pole and was beating him, and he absolutely insisted that that was a good thing to do and that that's what was done with him, et cetera, et cetera. This is an excellent program, and I'm sure there are a zillion other things other people want to say, but, man, this is good. So I'll just end it with that.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pugh. Okay, Brother Mosley, close us out, you and then Brother Alexander, and then Dr. Belcher, your closing remarks and thoughts. Now, we know you're coming back, so I'm not even worried about that. But let's just kind of how you want to end this from your perspective.
Okay, just in general, I think in terms of solutions, I think, and I'm going to focus on men here, I would like to see, just like there are the continuation of men's circles, where men, after they finish whatever education or whatever it may be, that these groups and these agencies have men's circles so that men can come after they've gone through their education and continue to be in dialogue for clarity, understanding, and the continuation of what they've learned. And the more that we can create these men's circles, these discussion groups that are voluntary, if that's possible, then the reinforcement of the change and the positive attitudes can remain. And they'll be willing to also extend those out to their family and et cetera, because it's being reinforced.
Excellent.
But I think that's one of the things we need. We need to have these men's circles, more of these around, to continue this kind of discussion.
Fantastic. Thank you. Mr. Alexander?
I know we're short on time. I'll say the formula of love over fear conquers all, ends all abuse and violence. We need to participate and operate that formula, love over fear. Thank you. Beautiful.
Thank you. And Dr. Belcher, you're the last voice.
Well, I would say that there's a lot that we still don't fully understand about the unique ways in which Black women endure domestic violence.
Right.
And this is because there's a lack of empirical research that's indicative of what may simply be a lack of empathy and concern for us Black women and our experiences. So we must all work to end the marginalization of Black women and focus energies as a community on amplifying Black women's voices and sharing what they go through at home and at work and in their communities to end violence against Black women in every facet of our society.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You all have been a joy and a gift in terms of this dialogue for our community. There's more that I know we need to say. There's more that can be said. And I am going to ask you to return very shortly, and let's continue on. Maybe this time start off with the solution point of view, and just see what we can do in terms of the healing process. We need to heal, as you all have said tonight. Thank our audience and those of you who were listening. We had a very full switchboard tonight. We had a lot of folk that were on switchboard. Some ended up dropping because we couldn't get to all of them. But we appreciate you, always, our listening audience. We'll be here next Tuesday, 8 o'clock p.m. We're supposed to have Dr. Conrad World with us next week. He has been out of town. He had a 105-year-old aunt that transitioned to the ancestral world. But he will be returning. He will be with us next Tuesday, hopefully, to discuss some things that we want to look at. So again, I thank all of you. Have a wonderful and very productive week, and we will see you next Tuesday.
Thank you, Doctor.
All right.